The case. Goran Goblika. The cognite. I may as well know as much as possible, so I can be of as much use as possible. I'm hardly a security risk if I'm going to be dead or insane by the end of the day. The cognite are a secret order, said Eisenhorn. You might think of them as a cult or coven. Their organization is very old. It may even predate the founding of the Imperium. Certainly, in the last few centuries, it has enjoyed a resurgence in these subsectors. The cognite are a pernicious threat to the very foundations of our society. They are ruthless, and they employ dangerous levels of intellectual rigor. What do they want? Asked Drusha. What does anybody want? Replied Eisenhorn. Power. Mastery. Control. They believe the domination of our culture, and indeed the liberation of our species, lies in the use of forbidden knowledge. Law that is heretical in nature and too dangerous for man to know. The secrets of the arch-enemy and the wisdom of the warp.
Do you mean magic?
That is a misleading term, but like ghost it will serve as far as you're concerned. The arch-enemy of man has the means to unlock and control the very fabric of reality. The cognite wish to acquire that ability for themselves.
And you're hunting them?
One way or another, for most of my life, I have worked to eradicate their evil, said Eisenhorn. In the last 2 decades, I have begun to unravel what I believe is a significant initiative on behalf of the cognite, an endeavor to achieve something of great magnitude.
What?
I don't know, Magos. They hide well. They work in secret. They recruit very effectively. They establish secret skolams on many worlds, institutions where they raise and train prospective members, radicalizing them in the process. I have uncovered several and learned scraps. I piece those scraps together. Whatever they are working towards, it is momentous. Lillian Chase.
Who's she?
A key member of the cognite, one of their adepts, brilliant and misguided, perhaps their leader in this quadrant. My hunt is for her in particular. A heretic of the most toxic kind. My intelligence suggests she works towards, or perhaps for, something called the Yellow King. This may be a person, or an entity, or simply a condition, a state of power and enlightenment. She must be found and stopped.
And this Goran man?
One of the scraps, Magos, said Eisenhorn. Part of the cognite network. He seemed lower priority, which is why I assigned Thea Inchabel to follow his trail. I fear she found something more. I fear Goran Goblika was not low priority at all.
This magic stuff, Drusha began.
Don't dwell on it, Drusha.
It is beyond my remit anyway, sir, replied Drusha. But your man Nail, he spoke of words of power. Words that can somehow break it.
Words may break it, but they also form it, said Eisenhorn. One of the cognite's most cherished goals is to unlock and rediscover enuncia. This is a language of power, a pre-human language that can literally manipulate reality. Apart from a few words and letters, no one knows it entirely. Lillian Chase has spent most of her life trying to decode it and build a working lexicon.
But you use it.
We use our enemy's weapons against them, said Eisenhorn.
So, you're not above heretical knowledge yourself?
It is the curse of the Ordos, Magos. We need to know the arch-enemy so we can prevail against him. That is why we stand in the shadows, why we walk alongside mankind and not as part of it. We are tainted by the knowledge we must use. It drives most of us to our dooms, eventually.
To your graves?
Or worse, said Eisenhorn.
Why do you do it? Asked Drusha.
And don't say because someone must, or anything like that. Why are you a Magos biologist, Drusha, when that calling has apparently given you a life you resent?
Because I'm good at it, said Drusha.
Yes, said Eisenhorn. It's sad, isn't it?
They reached the pool.
but for the low blanket of mist in the surrounding area, it was much as Drusha remembered it from the previous day. Nail, Vorier, and the deputies went ahead to scout, leaving Max and Audler Jaff with Eisenhorn and Drusha. Eisenhorn limped to the old, mossy stones and began to examine them. He took off his gloves to run his bare hands across their surfaces. Drusha watched the birds in the nearby trees for a while and counted off 8 species. Then he wandered over to join Eisenhorn. "Do they know you're hunting for them?" he asked.
"Who?"
"The Cognitae. This chase woman."
"Yes, Magos."
"And it would seem, from the fate of your poor associate Thea, they knew you had come close here."
"It would."
"Are you familiar with the white tile spider?" asked Drusha.
"Pretend I'm not," replied Eisenhorn.
"It's small, but venomous. An arachnid. Black, but with a small white square on its abdomen, hence the name. Elusive. It is preyed upon by a number of small lizard species. It has a habit of killing greenback beetles, which the lizards consider to be a delicacy. It does not eat the beetles. It leaves them dead, near its lair. This attracts the lizards, who feed on the beetles and slowly become paralyzed by the venom the white tile has injected into their bodies. Once the lizards are helplessly inert, the white tile emerges and kills them. It kills and feeds upon its own mortal enemy, creatures many times larger and more powerful than itself."
"That was an analogy, wasn't it?" said Eisenhorn.
"The bodies you found here in the Carinines," said Drusha. "That appears to me to be the oddest fact of all. Whatever's afoot here, whatever secret endeavour, why leave them where they can be found? Why draw attention where no attention was being paid?"
"You think this is a trap, Magos?"
"I think if you were hunting me, I'd want to find a way to stop that. You say the Cognitae are clever and devious. That thing that attacked us in Helta, animated by a word of power, I have no doubt."
"It was."
"It seems to me that it was animated once we were all here together. You had been absent for days, and several of your staff were away recruiting me. Only when we all returned did it strike. Because we were there to be killed. Brought there by the mystery of the bodies."
"Drusha," said Eisenhorn, "I am not worried that this is a trap. I am absolutely certain it is one. An effort I cannot ignore, too delicious to resist, intended to bring me to this place and end me forever."
Vorier clambered back up the slope to join them at the edge of the pool.
"Sir, we found the house," he said. "What's left of it?"
Chapter 14. Shade Hall. The hunting party moved through the forest from the pool.
"What did you find?" Drusha asked Nail.
"A ruin," said Nail, "deep in the undergrowth. From the scale of it, it may have been a fortress, but nothing stood there for a long time."
"How long?"
"Very long. Hundreds of years."
"That doesn't fit the data we have," said Drusha.
"That happens a lot in my line of work," Nail replied. "Unless you're prepared to scare yourself silly and believe it does fit the data. Just not the bits of the data you're comfortable thinking about."
"Garifar's Shade Hall?" Drusha laughed, nervously.
"I've seen worse things," said Nail.
He paused and reached into his backpack. He held out a small handgun to Drusha.
"It's the one I took off you," he said. "I took the liberty of cleaning it and loading it."
"Wasn't it loaded already?"
"These are better bullets," said Nail, "customized, from my special stash. I thought you might need something."
"I'm not really a gun person," said Drusha.
"Do me a favor and take it anyway, Magos," said Nail.
The stones that had once been a fortress lay tumbled together under the trees, swathed in moss and climbing creepers. The mist hung heavy and still. It had been a place of significant size. Some of the stone blocks were massive and suggested a heavy outer wall. But even these slabs, their edges worn smooth by years of erosion, were half buried in the loam. There was no longer even a sense of any ground plan that could be recognized.
"If this is Kestra," said
said Audler Jaff. "Then Kestra is not the site we are looking for. This isn't just derelict. It has been vacant for hundreds, if not thousands, of years."
"Audler's very pragmatic," Nail said to Drusha, sidelong. "She likes to deal in facts. She's not very taken with other possibilities."
His grin suggested he was sharing a joke with Drusha, but Drusha didn't find that reassuring. The idea that their speculation was correct, and some kind of supernatural truth lay beneath their immediate physical reality, was not reassuring.
"I heard your comment, Harlan," Jaff said. "The information provided by Magos Drusha asserted that Kestra had been occupied by Draven Sark and in use as recently as a few decades ago, but this intelligence was imparted as a byproduct of an auto-seance. The warp lies and deceives. Its whispers cannot be trusted, or at least cannot be understood on face value. The Magos' encounter with the ghost of Ezik Fargul is open to many interpretations, not least that it was utter ungrounded fancy." She walked through the undergrowth to a nearby tree and ran her hand across its bark.
"This is a southern spur pine, is it not, Magos?"
Drusha nodded.
"A mature specimen," said Jaff. "To reach this size, it would take, what, 300 years standard?"
"At least," Drusha admitted.
"Yet it, and others like it, are growing within the bounds of the site," said Jaff. "Kestra didn't collapse and perish in the last few decades. It has been gone long enough for 300 old trees to grow up through its bones."
Eisenhorn glanced at Vorier, who was scanning the area with a portable Auspex of a type Drusha hadn't seen before. "Nothing residual, sir," Vorier said. "Nothing electromagnetic or ectomagnetic. No background psionics. Of course, this device isn't as sensitive as you." The Inquisitor nodded. He limped through the ruin a little way until he was standing a short distance from them. Then he stopped and closed his eyes. Drusha and the others waited. Birdsong in the neighboring glades died away to silence. The breeze stilled, and there was a palpable drop in air temperature. "Remain calm," Vorier whispered to Drusha, Max, and the deputies. Max looked deeply uncomfortable.
"I'm going to circle the perimeter," she said.
Vorier nodded, and Max moved away quietly with Cronil and Edda in tow. Drusha got the feeling she was simply finding an excuse not to be present. It certainly wasn't comfortable. Though the sun continued to wink through the tree canopy above, light in the glade had somehow dimmed to an eerie dusk. Drusha realized his breath was steaming slightly in the cold air. He saw frost dusting the tree trunks and the ground cover leaves like powdered sugar. He looked up at the sun, twinkling beyond the leaves, to steady his nerves. The light slowly returned, the temperature rose, and birdsong resumed. Eisenhorn sighed. "Nothing," he said.
"Well," said Jaff, "I propose we return to Helter and make a new plan."
"There are no birds singing," said Drusha quietly.
"What, sir?"
asked Garifar.
"Around this site," said Drusha.
"No birdsong. You can hear it in the nearby areas, but not here."
He gestured towards a stand of trees outside the limits of the old ruin.
"I can see red beaks," he said, "and little-tailed skeins. There, up in the branches, there, see? But nothing comes this way. We've been here 10 minutes, and I haven't seen a single bird enter or cross this area."
"What does that mean?" asked Vorier.
Drusha shrugged and looked up at the sun again. There was movement in the undergrowth, and Max returned with the other two deputies. "There's a track," she said, "100 meters that way. Looks like it runs all the way down from the mountain trail. It's been in use. Wheeled vehicles. ATVs, I'd guess. Someone's been visiting this place, often and recently."
"But the track runs out," said Edda, 10 meters short of the ruin. "It just stops. Then thick undergrowth."
"Well then," said Jaff, "the visitors, hunters, I imagine, came that close and no closer."
"There's no turning circle," said Max. "No crush marks or compressed vegetation at the end of the trail where a heavy vehicle turned around.
I don't know about you, Mamsel Jaff, but I don't drive an ATV several kilometers down a very rough track and then just reverse back the way I came."
"Perhaps we put a watch on the head of the track," suggested Vorier. "See if these visitors come back." "You're very quiet, Drusha," said Eisenhorn. Drusha was still looking up at the trees.
"The trees are growing wrong," he said.
"Expand," said Eisenhorn.
all the trees growing within the ruin site," he said. "They're the same species as in the surrounding woods, but they have a slight inclination. You see it if you look. Growth patterning. It's to do with the elements. Prevailing wind directions, angle to the sun in different seasons, soil, rainfall. Like the hair on a man's scalp, growing in a natural pattern."
"I don't really see it," said Eisenhorn.
"It's the sort of thing I'm trained to notice," said Drusha. "Trust me. The thing is, the trees on this site are all growing to a slightly different pattern. It's subtle, but distinct."
"And what would cause that?" asked Eisenhorn.
Drusha frowned. "It's like," he began, "it's like they are growing in a different environment, responding to a different sun."
Eisenhorn looked over at Garifar.
"In the old stories for children, deputy," he asked, "how did an outsider find a shade hall? How did an outsider enter one?"
Garifar looked puzzled.
"Well, sir, they just appeared," he replied. "You could enter them when they were there, or you were taken there by the monsters who dwelt inside.
Nothing else? No folk tale rhyme or incantation?"
"I don't know," Garifar said. "There was one story about a fellow who called one up, I suppose like an incantation, but I don't know what words you'd use."
"Words," murmured Eisenhorn.
"Do you mean that language thing?" Drusha asked. "I think experimentation would be ill-advised," said Jaff.
"Your objection is noted," said Eisenhorn. "Sark's home was well hidden, unnaturally well hidden. It was a place of retreat, of escape. It was, in literal terms, occulted. This may be a false trail, or it may be that we are standing on the threshold of Sark's hall. I'm not leaving until we have exhausted all possibilities of making a definitive determination."
"Sir, it is a considerable risk," said Jaff.
"You said it yourself, Audler," replied Eisenhorn. "The word Kestra. You said the name translated as a forbidden speaking place, or place of unholy speech. If the Cognitae are hiding in the Carinines, they have built a place of seclusion and retreat, and proofed it against discovery using their darkest skills."
"I also stated that it's not a physical location, sir," said Jaff.
"Not at the moment," said Eisenhorn. "Not all the time, perhaps. I'd like everyone to prepare themselves. If this works, even in part, there may be some discomfort and disorientation."
Nail gripped Drusha firmly and securely by the upper arm. Drusha looked at his hand in surprise.
"What?" he started to say.
"Stick with me," Nail said.
Jaff was objecting again. Eisenhorn ignored her, raised his hands, and said something. It was a word, or at least it seemed to be. Drusha didn't know it or understand it. He'd never heard it before in his life, and he never wanted to hear it again.
Chapter 15. Simultaneous Reality Overlays.
"Stick with me," said Nail.
Drusha was clawing at his head with his fingers. There was a migraine-sharp knot of pain behind his eyes. He could smell blood in his throat. Nausea wallowed through him.
"What?"
he said.
"What? What?"
he heard Nail again, saying his name. Nail's voice was obscured by the sound of a drum. Drusha realized it was the blood pounding in his ears.
"What?"
he repeated, frantically.
"What did it mean? What did he say?"
He retched hard and fell, dry heaving, onto the cold stone floor. His stomach was in spasm. Nail crouched beside him and patted him on the back.
"Take it slow," he said. "You'll level out in a moment."
Drusha nodded. Couldn't talk.
"You all right?"
Nail asked. Drusha rocked back on his heels and knelt, panting.
"I don't know what..."
he gasped, wiping his mouth.
"That word... that sound... I don't understand what he said. I don't understand what the word was."
"Stay calm," said Nail. "Take a few breaths."
"Why are you whispering?"
Drusha asked.
"Just stay calm."
Drusha shifted position because the hard stone floor was digging into his knees. Hard stone floor. Drusha looked down and jumped to his feet with a startled cry.
"Take it easy,"
said Nail. Drusha slowly looked around. The room was some kind of vaulted chamber of unusual height. The walls and arched ceiling were made of fashioned white stone. The floor was dark green marble. There were tall lancet windows of stained glass. Exterior light shafted into the room through the windows, covering the floor with a multicolored pattern. He looked at Nail.
"We were right," said Nail.
Drusha shook his head.
"Please tell me," he said, "that I passed out or something, and you took me back to Helter."
"No," said Nail.
"But we were in the woods," said Drusha.
"And now we're not," replied Nail. "Except I think we are. We're in the woods and inside Kestra."
"Where are the others?"
asked Drusha.
"Not sure," said Nail. "But if we've appeared inside the hall, or it's manifested around us, whatever, then..."
He gestured to the wall.
"Max and Jaff were over there, the others just beyond them. So that wall appeared between us."
"I really can't tell you how much I don't like this," said Drusha.
"I hear you," said Nail. "Stay right here, and don't touch anything."
Nail unslung his las rifle and stalked towards the door. Drusha clenched his fists to stop his hands trembling. He looked around. The air was cool, and there was a lingering background scent of promethium or some similar industrial petrochemical. The room was unfurnished, apart from an unmade wooden cot, a small chair, and a blanket box. He walked over to the windows. There was light outside. The glow of it was dyed in greens and reds and golds by the stained glass. He had to stand on tiptoe to peer out. He swallowed hard.
"Nail,"
he whispered,
"we're not in the woods."
Jermaine Max closed her eyes and opened them again. But it was all still there. She was standing on a metal walkway, suspended over fathomless darkness. Around her, in the gloom, huge mechanisms turned and whirred. Brass cogs many meters in diameter locked teeth with others of their kind, and turned in smooth and uniform perfection. Smaller flywheels rotated rapidly, humming as they whirled. Iron pistons hissed pneumatic sighs, and copper valves opened and closed with automated regularity. The place smelled of oil and hot metal, like a vast machine shop.
"This is real, isn't it?"
she whispered.
"I'm afraid so," replied Jaff.
She was standing on the walkway beside Max. She had drawn a small pistol.
"We were in the woods,"
Max began.
"And now we are not, Marshal," said Jaff. "I am as surprised as you are, but we must not give in to shock or disorientation. My master was right. We have been translated."
"Into what?"
Max asked.
"Into where?" replied Jaff. "A sideways shift. The site of Kestra evidently represents a bend in the geometry of dimensional reality, and we have stepped around that blind corner."
"This is..."
Max started to say, but thought better of it.
"What do we do?"
"Keep our wits and find Eisenhorn," replied Jaff. "It is likely we are neither alone nor safe here."
She moved along the walkway, her weapon ready. Metal steps led down to a lower gantry that ran beneath a section of huge, whirring cogs.
"What is this machine?"
asked Max, following her. She had her riot gun ready.
"I am not able to evaluate that at this time," replied Jaff.
She held up her hand suddenly, a signal for quiet. Max had heard it too, voices ahead of them. Max and Jaff picked their way down the steps quietly. The lower gantry was quite broad. The mechanism purred both above and below it. At the far end, near a further set of steps, they saw Garifar and Edda.
"Garifar!"
Max hissed, as loudly as she dared. The two deputies turned at the sound of her voice, their weapons raised. They lowered them as soon as they saw Max and Jaff, and came hurrying along the gantry towards them.
"Thank the throne!"
gasped Edda. She was clearly shaken, her mind unable to cope. There was shock in Garifar's eyes, too, but he was holding it together.
"This is the Shade Hall, isn't it?"
he said to Jaff.
"It seems there was some basis to the myth, deputy," she replied.
"Did we open a door?"
he asked.
"How could this place be in the woods and we not see a trace of it?"
"I want to go now," said Edda.
"I want to go away from here, right now."
"We are still in the Carinine Woods,"
Jaff said to Garifar,
"and yet we are simultaneously not."
"What does that even mean?"
he spat back.
"I could explain at great length about simultaneous reality overlays," said Jaff. "About areas of binary dimension. I imagine I would be wasting my time. Put simply, this is an extremely rare cosmic phenomenon. An X-timate location. Two places occupying the same point of space at the same time, one overlaid on the other, and only one of them ever visible at a time, depending on the position of the observer. This is the woodland ruins, and it is this structure. We were in one, now we are in the other. Our location hasn't changed. Our position of observation has. Does that help?"
"No," said Garifar.
"Then we have been taken through a fairy ring into your shade hall, deputy," Jaff said with contempt.
"What do we do?"
Garifar asked Max.
"We get out of here,"
Edda replied, her voice rising in panic.
"We get the hell out!"
"Rein it in, Edda," said Max. She got hold of the trembling deputy and almost shook her by the shoulders. "Edda! Edda! Look at me. Look at me now. I'm going to sort this out. I need you to keep a lid on, all right? Edda, can you do that?" Edda nodded, swallowing hard.
"Yes. Yes, ma'am."
"We need to find the others," said Jaff. "Eisenhorn, Nail, Vorier, Magos Drusha, and your other deputy. They may be nearby."
"We haven't seen anybody except you," said Garifar.
Max adjusted her collarvox. "Nail, this is Max. Do you copy? Colonel, are you reading me? This is Max." She looked at Jaff. "The vox is dead," she said. "The frequency spectrum may be different here," said Jaff.
"How do you know that?"
asked Garifar. "I don't," said Jaff. "It's just an educated guess." She turned and looked down the next set of metal steps. It descended to another platform. Other walkways branched off it. Steps led up to higher platforms, obscured by the humming machinery. She looked at Max. "Stay here," she said. "I'll scout along here." "We should stay together," said Max. "I'll be quick," said Jaff. "Stay here and take a moment to get yourselves together. I'm going to need you to be able to focus." She turned and hurried silently down the metal steps. They watched her cross the lower platform, then disappear from view behind slowly circling brass gears the size of banquet tables.
"How long do we wait?"
asked Garifar. "Until she comes back," replied Max.
"What if she doesn't?" he said.
"Let's not get pessimistic," said Max. She tilted her head towards Edda, who was twitching with unease, unable to stand still. Max knew how the deputy felt. She wasn't far off a panic attack herself. Her hands were shaking badly. Garifar took the hint.
"Come on, Edda," he said, trying to sound reassuring. "We're going to be all right."
He went to put his arm around her shoulders. There was a sharp, wet pop, like a water bottle bursting. Garifar's face was suddenly speckled with liquid. Edda sagged into him, heavy and limp. He tried to hold her up, her head lolled back, and a huge quantity of blood welled out of a hole in her throat.
"Shoot her!"
he yelled. The second shot hit him in the ribs, knocking him aside. Garifar and Edda crashed over onto the platform together. Max dropped to her knees, her riot gun raised. There was no way in hell to tell where the shots had come from.
"Drop it," a voice boomed.
"Magistratum!" Max yelled, her weapon up to her cheek, hunting. "Go screw yourself!"
"Drop it," the voice repeated. "The male is only wounded. He could be saved, but not if you resist."
Max glanced frantically at Garifar. He was sprawled on his back, blood bubbles popping as he opened and closed his mouth in silent shock. Breathing hard, Max slowly lowered the riot gun. She put it on the metal deck and raised her hands to show they were empty. Then she moved quickly to Garifar's side and clamped her palms over the chest wound. There was blood everywhere. It was running through the platform mesh underneath Garifar, catching the light as it spattered away into the darkness. Two people appeared, moving up the lower gantry towards Max. One was a heavy-set bearded male in a chain-mesh combat jacket. The other was a slighter figure, a woman with tightly cropped red hair. Both were covering Max with suppressed auto-rifles. Two more, both male, approached from the other direction. One was overweight and jowly, with thin grey hair. He carried an assault las rifle with a modified scope and combat grips. The other was a very tall, thin man with neck and cheek tattoos. He covered Max with a pair of las pistols. The bearded man came up the steps to Max as the other three kept back, covering her. He was swarthy, with jet-black hair. His piercing eyes were an odd violet colour. He looked down at Max.
"For throne's sake, help him!"
Max yelled, her hands locked flat over the wound in Garifar's torso.
"He's done for,"
called the overweight man, edging closer, his weapon aimed.
"You can see that. But she's intact, though."
"You said you'd help him," Max pleaded.
"I say all sorts of things," replied the bearded man. "Blake is right. He's done for."
"No, get a bloody med kit,"
cried Max. The man with the violet eyes sighed. He brought up his auto rifle and puffed two noise-limited shots into Garifar's head. Max screamed and launched herself at the bearded man, clawing with blood-soaked hands. He snapped his auto-rifle around like a club and met her face with the stock. Nail opened the door and looked out.
"You think you can be quiet now, Megas?" he whispered over his shoulder.
"Yes,"
said Drusha. He'd calmed down a little.
"Follow me," said Nail. "Stick with me. Do as I tell you."
Drusha nodded. Nail looked at him, eyes narrowed.
"Say it, quietly but clearly,"
he said.
"I need to know where you are. I won't be looking at you."
"I understand,"
said Drusha.
"Yes."
Nail looked at Drusha for a moment, as if gauging how far he could trust him to behave. Then he appeared to make his mind up.
"Follow," he whispered.
With the rifle up against his cheek, Nail opened the door wider. Then he switched his hand to the foregrip and edged out, panning the powerful assault weapon from side to side. Drusha followed him. The door led into a long, high hallway. The walls were the same seamless white stone as the room, the floor the same green marble. It was gloomy, and there was a constant distant humming noise. Murky light seeped in through high window lights. The proportions of the hallway were odd. It was wide enough for three men to walk together side by side, but the ceiling was so high it felt narrow and confined. Drusha guessed the ceiling was 5 or 6 meters up. It seemed a curious choice, so much wasted space above head height. Despite the open air above him, he felt claustrophobic, oppressed by the blank, chalk-white walls. Why build a corridor that shape? Was its grand architecture supposed to impress and intimidate? Then why so plain and austere? He was frankly glad the window lights were too high for him to see out of them. His old adversary, imagination, decided to make mischief. The thought came to him that this was a very narrow corridor, a single-file passageway for very tall people. People so tall they could see out of the high windows, because they would be at head height, and those tall people, therefore, wouldn't be people at all.
"All right?"
Nail asked.
"Yes,"
whispered Drusha.
"You started breathing funny again," Nail noted.
He wasn't looking at Drusha. He was prowling along the hallway, hunched, weapon aimed, ready to fire. Drusha wondered why Nail had chosen to go right instead of left. Both directions looked identical, the slender hallway advancing away as far as he could see.
"Megas,"
Nail prompted.
"Yes," said Drusha. "I'm fine."
He wanted to ask about the window. He wanted to ask Nail about what he had seen through it, but it clearly wasn't the time. Nail had looked through the window, too. He had made no comment, as if the view had been what he had expected to see, or as if he'd seen it before. Drusha doubted both options. During their brief acquaintance, Drusha had come to know Nail as a man who rarely registered any kind of reaction. There was another door a few meters down on the right. Like the first, it was made of some kind of dense, pale wood, polished until it gleamed. The handle was silver.
"Stay with me," said Nail.
"Yes,"
said Drusha.
"First priority is to find the others,"
said Nail.
"I think they'll be close. I think our positions will be relative to the ones we were in when we..."
He paused, thinking of the right word. Drusha was guessing left.
"We're still in the woods,"
Nail finished.
"And if they aren't?"
he asked.
"Then I've got even less to go on than I hoped," said Nail.
He reached the door. He listened at it for a moment, then turned the handle and let it swing open with a prod of his toe. He stepped in. Drusha followed. The room was identical to the one they had first found themselves in. A light, Drusha now knew was not the sun, shone through stained glass lancets. There was no cot, just 4 wooden chairs, arranged in a square with their backs together. There were marks made in blue chalk around the feet of the chairs, meaningless scribbles that were somehow unpleasant to look at. Drusha found himself staring at them. One of the chairs was slightly out of alignment with the others, and, driven by an obsessive-compulsive urge, he reached out to straighten it. Nail's big hand clamped around his wrist.
"Don't touch anything," he said firmly, "no matter how much you want to."
"Yes," said Drusha, clearly.
He had no idea why he'd felt so compelled. He glanced fitfully at the stained glass windows. Like the ones in the previous room, their pattern appeared random, purely decorative. Surely the point of stained glass was to make a picture. The coloured panes were used to assemble an image, a saint perhaps, or something symbolic. This was just a patchwork of green and red and gold shapes, fixed together with leading. Except it wasn't. He stared. There were recognisable forms there. Figures. Elongated figures, swaying, with long, intertwined limbs that...
"Don't look at the windows either," said Nail.
"Yes,"
said Drusha, looking at the plain white wall instead.
"They're not here," said Nail. "They should have been on the other side of this wall, if..."
He sighed, as though it were too much effort to finish, or too distressing to explain the context.
"What does that mean, Nail?" Drusha asked.
"It means we didn't bilocate together," said Nail. "Or we did, and we didn't arrive in our relative positions. Or we're not time-synchronized. Or..."
He glanced at Drusha.
"I'm just upsetting you now, aren't I?" he asked.
"No, I'm fine," said Drusha.
"You sure? You made a noise. A sort of groan."
"No, I didn't,"
said Drusha.
"I think you did."
"I think I'd know."
"I don't think you would."
"Nail."
"All right," said Nail. "This is a difficult experience, and your mind's not really focused yet. I can see the lost look in your eyes. That's all right. You'll get your bearings. But it's possible you groaned without knowing it, because this is all too much to take in."
"Are you finding it a difficult experience?" asked Drusha.
"Yeah,"
said Nail.
"Then you're hiding that well. Has this happened to you before?"
"Not this exactly, no."
"Then something like it?"
"I've had experiences," said Nail. "Things like this that would scare you bloodless. But not this exactly."
"How do you deal with it?"
"I've been dealing with it for years," said Nail. "One thing I've learned, if you don't deal with these kinds of situations quickly, you're no good to anyone, including yourself."
"Insane adventures,"
murmured Drusha.
"Exactly, Magus."
"You weren't lying."
"No,"
said Nail. He flashed a quick smile that Drusha took as an attempt to be supportive.
"For your sake, Drusha, I wish I had been."
"What do we do, Nail?" Drusha asked.
"We keep looking. We keep looking for the others. It's about all we can do."
"What about... can you not say the word again? The word Eisenhorn said. Can't you take us back?"
"I'm sorry," said Nail. "I don't know what he said either. Enuncia is beyond my pay grade."
Drusha breathed heavily and nodded. He walked over to the windows.
"What are you doing? Magus?"
Drusha stood on tiptoe and looked through the stained glass. Nail pulled him back.
"Don't do that," he said. "It made you cry last time."
"That's why I have to," said Drusha. "You're right. I'm lost. My mind's all over the place. I'm not really coping. Which means I'm no use to you at all. The sooner I face up to reality and get it together, the better. Think of this as aversion therapy."
Nail frowned, then let go of him. Drusha stood back up on his toes. He saw the world outside through the coloured glass of the old window. No sunlit woodland, no forest glade, no blue skies, no cobalt edge of the Carinine Ridge in the afternoon haze. No Gershom. Outside was a grey desert. Dunes of dust stretched away as far as he could see, broken by outcrops of rock that looked like the calcified vertebra of long-dead leviathan creatures. A thin wind lifted powder from the crests of the dunes, winnowing it into the air like sea spray. The sky was black and starless. A bone-white curve, like an immense tusk of light, rose from the horizon into the sky. It was a moon, or a close neighbor planet, rising in the sky in three-quarter shadow, impossibly close. The black void sky had one feature, a blue-white whirl that radiated the light he'd first taken to be the sun's rays. The whirl was immense, a nebula or some kind of stellar vortex, gleaming fiercely like the negative image of a black hole. trailing arms of frosty light and energy clouds radiated from the heart of it. It looked to Drusha like a vast eye gazing back at him. Drusha let it look. He held its stare and returned it, unblinking. Then he lowered himself onto his heels and turned away from the window.
"All right," he said to Nail. "I have a little perspective now. I've got my head together."
"You sure?"
"Positive, Nail. Lead on. Let's find the others."
Nail hesitated.
"I only ask because you groaned again."
"I didn't," said Drusha.
"I'm sorry, but you did. Involuntarily, I'm sure, but..."
Drusha held up his hand sharply. Nail had heard it too. A soft, stifled moan.
"I told you it wasn't me," Drusha said.
"It came from the hallway,"
said Nail.
"Come on." "Just calm the hell down and let me think," said Vorier.
Deputy Cronel glared at him. His face was flushed, and he looked set to throw a punch at the interrogator.
"Please," said Vorier softly. "I know this is very distressing. I am fighting to process it myself." "But how can we be here all of a sudden?"
Cronel snarled.
"Just give me a moment," said Vorier. "Just a moment."
He looked at the ancient machinery spinning in the twilight around them. Such an extraordinary device.
Could it be? Could the rumors, the uncorroborated intelligence, could they all have been true?
The heretic scum actually possessed this thing. And it was working. This, he decided with a wince of grief, this secret was why Thea had died.
"Here's what we're going to do," he said, turning to Cronil.
Something slammed into Cronel and flipped him. The deputy landed on the metal deck with a yowl of pain. A savage spin kick connected with Vorier's jaw, snapping him off his feet. The attacker was a woman with severely cropped red hair. Cronel tried to rise, but she jerked down with a snarl and put a punch dagger through his spine. The deputy collapsed on his face, his body twitching, his last exhalation a long, slow, choking wheeze. Vorier rolled, dragging out his transvasor automatic. The woman kicked and deflected his aim. His shot went wide, the report echoing around in the darkness. Vorier scrambled backwards on his rear, trying to re-aim. She lunged in and clamped his wrist with her left hand, twisting the pistol aside. He kicked out and took her legs away. She rolled as she fell, jerking his clamped wrist into over-rotation. Vorier gasped in pain. She locked her other hand around the bicep of his pinned arm and pivoted, hauling him head first over her and breaking his arm at the same time. Vorier howled. The woman sprang up and stamped on his outstretched hand, breaking his fingers around the grip of the pistol. She kicked the gun clear of his useless hand. He swung at her with his left fist, trying to ignore the overload of pain. She blocked the blow and drove a beak fist into his throat. Vorier fell back, choking, eyes wide, unable to breathe, unable to rise. The red-haired woman straddled his chest and stared down at him. She rested her beak fist against his brow.
"Submit," she whispered, "and the remains of your life will have a purpose."
Vorier couldn't speak. He spat instead. Blood and spittle hit her cheek. She hammer-tapped her beak fist against his forehead and bounced the back of his skull off the metal deck. They followed the hallway to its far end. Nail ignored other doors as they passed them. The sound was coming from up ahead. As they approached, it grew louder. The constant background hum grew louder too. It wasn't a moaning. It wasn't someone in pain or distress. It sounded more like a voice unable to articulate. A voice that wanted to speak, and was trying to speak, but which had never learned any words. Drusha thought of Max, and the way she had been reduced to inarticulate gasps by the thing in the kitchen passage. Fear had done that to her. She had briefly been reduced to wordless terror by something that defied her mind's ability to process it. But Jermaine Max was clever and sharp-witted, and she had a considerable and sometimes salty vocabulary. This sound had a quite different quality. It was a human voice. It wasn't groping in fear, trying to find some words, the way Max had been. It was vocalizing in despair, trying to make words. Drusha took a moment to steady himself. Just thinking about Max had made him upset. He wondered where she was. He wondered if he would see her again. He imagined her, wherever she was, being as scared now as she had been in the passageway. It was a thought he could scarcely bear.
"Megas,"
he looked up. Nail was beckoning to him. There was a hatch at the end of the hallway.
It was clearly Imperial tech, a heavy-duty hatch like a shift ship's airgate. It looked incongruous, as if it had been retrofitted into the old, eerie architecture of the building. Why would you put something that massive and secure into a place where polished wooden doors with silver handles were otherwise sufficient? And if the answer to that question was security, what did you keep on the other side? And why would you then leave the hatch wide open? Drusha joined Nail, and they peered in through the hatch. The chamber beyond was vast and cylindrical. Drusha guessed that it was the interior of one of the fortress's main towers. All the original floors and stairways had been removed. The curved walls soared up into darkness above them and dropped away into darkness far below. The walls had been etched with lines. It was script. Hundreds of thousands of lines of writing, covering every centimetre of the interior walls in perfect, uniform rows. It must have taken decades for skilled artisans to inscribe it all. Drusha wondered what it said. He was too far away to be able to read any of it. The hatch led out onto a railed, metal landing inside the hall. The landing hung like a balcony under the hatch. Open metal steps led down to other platform stages below and several further above them. The platforms and connecting steps were all standard template units. Imperial build, the kind seen in manufactories and Promethean plants and all manner of workspaces and human habitations across the Imperium. There was something oddly reassuring about their familiarity, but, like the hatch, they seemed uncomfortably out of place in the setting. Around them, filling the main space of the tower, was vast technology of another sort. This was the source of the constant humming. To Drusha, it looked as if someone had taken all the complex inner mechanisms of an antique mechanical timepiece, enlarged them, then slotted them carefully into the drum of the tower. Cogs, gears, springs and winders whirred and moved in perfect, oiled precision. The crude STC platform sections and steps had been suspended inside the vast brass mechanism, allowing access to it at different levels. On some platforms, powerful cogitator units and workstations had been bolted in place, connected by sheaves of cables and data wires to the great machine. Drusha saw their screens and displays flickering with bright lines of changing data, monitor positions from which to study and perhaps even operate the strange and ancient mechanism. The air was dry and smelled of metal filings, oil, and warm power systems. There was a large platform directly below them, a circular gantry fixed in the center of the tower's interior. In the middle of it was a square iron cage, crudely heavy and filthy black. Inside the cage was a man. He was naked. His skin was dirty, scarred and blistered. His hair was long and ragged and hung over his face and shoulders. He was kneeling on the floor of the cage, hunched over, trembling. The guttural, moaning sounds were coming from him. Nail glanced at Drusha, then led the way out onto the landing. His weapon was up and ready at his cheek. As they moved, he covered each angle and turn. They edged down the metal steps onto the circular gantry. Drusha could smell the rank stench of the man in the cage. The sounds he was making made Drusha's skin crawl. The man heard them approach, or smelled them. It felt to Drusha like an animal response. He looked up at them in terror. Drusha saw his wild eyes staring through the matted fringe of his hair. He murmured something and backed away into the far corner of the cage. Drusha peered at him.
"Any idea who that is?"
he whispered to Nail. Nail was watching the hatch and the other platforms for signs of movement.
"No," he replied. "Not a clue. But it looks like the poor bastard's been in there for a while, Magos."
"Magos?"
They both looked around. The man in the cage was timidly rising to his feet, hunched, pawing the lank hair out of his eyes so he could stare at them. They saw a dirty, broken face that had been ravaged by years of pain and anguish.
"Magos,"
the man said. His mouth moved oddly as he spoke, as if he was working very hard to articulate. A man speaking a language that he had just learned, or which he had forgotten years before.
"Magos,"
he said.
"You can speak," said Drusha.
"Watch yourself,"
Nail warned.
"Magos,"
the man said. He edged towards them.
"Magos,"
he repeated.
I am. That is me. I am the Magos. You know me.
Do you have a name? Asked Drusha.
Magos,
the man replied with an anxious nod.
I am the Magos. Magos Sark.
Nail and Drusha glanced at each other quickly.
Are you Draven Sark? Nail asked sternly. Answer me. Are you Magus Draven Sark?
The man nodded furiously. He was panting. Drusha saw a weird expression on his face. He was baring his teeth like a dog. He was trying to smile.
Will you let me out?
He asked.
Please. I am Draven Sark. Magus Draven Sark. And I would like to come out of here now.
It depends, replied Nail. Who put you in there?
He put himself in there, said Jaff.
Nail and Drusha turned around sharply. She was standing on the gantry beside them. She looked scared.
The hell did you come from?
Nail exclaimed. Jaff gestured to the chamber around them.
I found this place. I've been looking around.
Where are the others?
Asked Nail.
I'm not sure, she said. What do you mean, he put himself in there? Asked Drusha. I've been trying to access data from the terminals in this chamber, she said. It's definitely a cognitive facility, and it's been here a very long time. How long? Asked Drusha.
Never mind that, snapped Nail. Tell us about Sark.
He didn't build this place, but he's run it for the cognitive for the last century or so, running its program.
Program for what? Asked Drusha.
I don't know that yet, she replied. But from the notes I found, it seems that Magos Sark was so desperate to get a result, he placed himself in that cage.
Yes, because that's what scientists do, said Drusha.
He made himself his own laboratory test subject, said Jaff witheringly. He is clearly damaged and obsessive. That cage is a psychometric monitor, and Sark is his own lab rat.
We need to know a lot more than that, said Nail.
Well, I was working on it, said Jaff. Then I saw you.
Nail lowered his rifle and looked around. He walked to the gantry rail.
"Which terminal were you using, Audler?" he asked. "Where did you get this information from?"
Audler Jaff raised her hand as if to point, but she was holding a compact, snub-nosed las pistol. She fired. The shot hit Nail in the back. He lurched forwards, toppled over the rail, and fell. Drusha stared, his mouth wide open. Jaff turned the weapon on him.
He was too dangerous to live, she said. But you are containable. And new test subjects are always useful.
Chapter 16 The Bad Place. Jaff took a step towards Drusha and placed the muzzle of her sidearm against his forehead. Expressionless, she reached forwards with her other hand and began patting the pockets of his old coat. She stopped, reached in, and fished out the gun Nail had given him. She stepped back, keeping her weapon trained on him, and put the confiscated gun in the hip pocket of her jacket. Sark had hunched down in the cage in fear, and was grunting and moaning again. Over her shoulder she called out, "Clear!" in a strong, loud voice. Her aim never wavered.
"How long?" Drusha asked her.
"How long what? How long have you been working against the orders?"
"Since the day I was born, Magos," she said. "I am the product of a cognite breeding school. I was engineered as a savant, precisely the sort of exceptional individual a man like Gregor Eisenhorn finds appealing and useful, the sort of person he recruits."
"I suppose that explains why you've been so unhelpful every step of the way," said Drusha. "Someone like you should have worked out Kestra's location in a matter of hours. But you already knew where it was. You were trying to stop us finding it." She smiled.
"Your face is an open book, Magos Drusha," she said. "Microspasms in your platysma, zygomaticus, and levator labii superiosus, involuntary dilation of the pupils. You are terrified. Your composure is a front. Bravado."
"My levator labii superiosus is doing just fine," replied Drusha. "Of course I'm terrified. You just killed a man, and you're aiming a gun at me. You realize your fate will be appalling." "I don't know what it will be, precisely. But I doubt the Inquisition treats heretics with much mercy."
"It does not," she agreed. "But then, you're not working with the Inquisition. The Rot God King's holy orders have no inkling of this affair. Eisenhorn is a rogue, Magos. He is extreme and dangerous even by their standards.
They declared him hereticus many years ago, and they hunt him as keenly as they hunt the cognite. There. The platysma again. You didn't know that.
I guessed, said Drusha. This whole operation lacked legitimacy. I don't know him well, but I believe he is determined...
Oh, Eisenhorn believes his cause is just, in his arrogance.
And he hunts for you.
Bringing down the cognite is his life's work, she said. The ruthless zeal with which he pursues us is the main reason he was disowned by his Ordo masters. Be clear, Magos Drusha. No one is waiting to hear from him. No one is coming to save you. No one knows you're here. He's done. You're all done.
You say that confidently, Mademoiselle Jaffe, but you're not certain, are you? A twitch of the masseter, a little tremble of the corrugator supercilii. Doubt, plain as day.
Jaffe frowned and shot her free hand to her face involuntarily.
You're a little shit, she said, glaring at him.
Drusha smiled back. He was no reader of micro-expressions. He'd made it up just to rattle her.
He heard footsteps. A man was coming up the metal steps onto the gantry. He was tall and heavy-set, with piercing violet eyes that contrasted strangely with his olive skin, jet-black hair and full beard. He wore a leather jack suit with a mesh armor jacket. A large auto-rifle hung across his shoulder. Three people followed him, a hard-faced woman with cropped red hair, a tall, heavily tattooed man, and an overweight man with hooded eyes.
"Why is he alive, Jaffe?"
the bearded man asked. His voice was extraordinarily deep.
"A usable subject, Goblika," she replied. "High intelligence quotient."
The man looked at Drusha as if he was an annoying stain on a good carpet. Goblika. Drusha recognized the name. The heretic Eisenhorn's interrogator had been hunting on Gershom.
"Have you questioned him?"
Goblika asked Jaffe.
"He knows nothing."
"Establish that as a fact," hissed Goblika. "Thanks to your poor work, the agents of the damn Ordos are inside the hall. I want them all found and extinguished, so we'd better know everything they know."
Drusha saw the look on Jaffe's face. That was a micro-expression he understood. Jaffe was terrified of Goblika. Drusha had no doubt this stemmed from Goblika's imposing physicality and charming manners, but he was also sure Jaffe had something to prove. She hadn't sprung the trap and killed them all cleanly at Helter. She'd let them get inside Kestra. She was clearly keen to demonstrate her competence and make up for the error. Drusha doubted the cognite offered much in the way of second chances to those in their service.
"Where's Eisenhorn?"
Jaffe asked, her weapon still aimed.
"I don't know," said Drusha.
"True?"
asked Goblika.
"Yes," said Jaffe. "He couldn't cloak a response to that question."
Goblika nodded.
"Take him down to the cellar cages," said Goblika.
Jaffe hesitated.
"What?"
Goblika asked.
"Can't Blague or Streak I'll do it?" she asked.
"Do it your bloody self, Jaffe,"
sneered the overweight man.
"I want to get back out," said Jaffe to Goblika. "Betancourt is outside. The remaining loose end. I need to deal with her, and I'm the best choice to get close to her."
"Put him away. Then you can go,"
said Goblika. Jaffe looked at Drusha and gestured with her gun. He went where she told him to go. Jaffe walked behind him, covering him with her weapon. They descended from the gantry and followed a route down the tower, crossing platforms and walking down suspended staircases, the brass wheels and gears of the great machine whirring around them. Drusha tried not to feel alarm at the immense drop below them. His good old fear of heights. A gun at his back served to focus his mind.
"What does it do?" he asked. "Shut up," she said.
"You're making something. This machine.
It's very old, isn't it?" "Drusha, you're not that useful. Shut up."
Drusha felt an odd tingling sensation in the base of his skull. He stopped walking and leaned on a handrail.
"Keep walking," she said.
"Just a minute," Drusha said. "I feel faint." He looked out at the machinery, at the other platforms and walkways. He looked at the shadows, hoping. The tingle throbbed in the back of his head. He straightened up.
"All right," he said. "I feel better now."
He looked at Jaffe and gestured at the great machine.
"Come on, how old?" he asked.
She jabbed the gun in his ribs.
"Walk," she hissed.
"You can't blame me for being fascinated, mademoiselle. It's my job to inquire. My life's work.
As now, you have no life.
He looked around thoughtfully.
These tests. What is my fate going to be, Audler?
She frowned at him.
Painful, she said.
Oh, he shrugged. That's a shame.
I really don't do pain well.
What sort of pain?
Walk,
she snapped. Seriously, so I can brace myself. She put the gun against his forehead again.
Be obedient, she said. Shut up and walk. You are very annoying.
So I've been told, said Drusha. You know, I don't think I will walk any more. I think, on balance, I'd rather die than submit to these tests you mentioned. I'm not good with pain. I'd rather it was quick. He closed his eyes. There was a sharp crack. Drusha opened his eyes again. Audler Jaff's limp body lay at his feet.
You took your time, Drusha said. I didn't know how much more crap I could come out with to keep her distracted.
You did just fine, said Eisenhorn.
Have you killed her? Drusha said.
Eisenhorn hunched over her body.
Not yet, he said.
She killed Nail, said Drusha.
She has betrayed me on every level,
replied Eisenhorn. He searched Jaff's pockets, found Drusha's gun, and held it out to him.
I was actually quite pleased to see the back of that, Drusha said.
Take it, Magos. You need to be armed. I think we're the only two left.
Drusha took the gun reluctantly.
I heard you whisper in my head, he said.
He rubbed the back of his skull.
Right in the back there. It was unpleasant.
I had to signal to you without her hearing, said Eisenhorn. I had to get you to stop so I could get close. I didn't want to risk a shot. It wasn't easy.
Why? Asked Drusha. What do you mean? Eisenhorn let out a long, slow breath. Drusha could see that his flesh was pallid, and he was perspiring.
This place, he confessed. This machine. It's interfering with my mind. It's radiating a latent power that's conflicting with my Psychana gifts. It's taking more effort than usual to use them. And when I do, I can manage short range only.
Then don't, said Drusha. You'll exhaust yourself.
I'll use what I have to, Magos,
Eisenhorn replied.
When I have to, for as long as I can. My gifts are about the only edge we have over the cognite.
What is this machine, Inquisitor?
I'm not certain, replied Eisenhorn, but I think it's a device called an immaterium loom.
Which is?
It spins things out of the warp, said Eisenhorn. It binds the etheric with the physical. There have been rumors for centuries that the cognite were trying to build one. I didn't give those rumors much credence, but yet again the cognite dismay me.
He hoisted Jaff's limp body upright and glanced at Drusha.
Can you support her? It'll only be for a moment.
Drusha moved forwards to help.
Immaterium looms are volatile things, said Eisenhorn. No one's ever made one before, though many have tried over the millennia. Heretics and imperial adepts alike. All prototypes have built up interference patterns with the fabric of reality and imploded.
But this place, it isn't reality?
Asked Drusha, propping Jaff upright.
As usual, you're sharp,
said Eisenhorn.
This place, Kestra, is a weak point in the fabric between our reality and the warp. I think it always has been. A liminal place of monsters, feared by the ancient Eudaric tribes who gave it its ominous name, becoming part of folklore, as all such bad places do. The cognite have exploited this weakness in real space fabric and built this place in the in-between.
To hide?
Yes. And now I know they can do it, I realize they may have other such bolt holes across the Imperium in other bad places. Which is why they have always been so damned elusive. But here there is a secondary purpose.
Because we're in the warp? Asked Drusha.
We're in an interstitial space between reality and the warp,
Eisenhorn replied.
It's called an extimate zone. But yes, it is a laboratory-perfect environment in which to build an immaterium loom and set it running without risk of real space contamination interfering with its function.
That's all speculation, I take it? Asked Drusha.
For now. Let's ask Jaff about it, said Eisenhorn. Hold her.
He stepped back.
Audler.
Drusha shivered. He felt the woman quiver in his arms. Her head snapped upright.
Should you be doing that?
he asked nervously.
"I mean, if your powers are limited and—"
"I need information," said Eisenhorn. "Let her go and step away." Drusha moved to Eisenhorn's side. Adler Jaff was standing upright, clenched stiffly and awkwardly. Her eyes were open, but she was looking at nothing.
"Please," she whispered.
"I trusted you."
Frost crystals began to form on the metal decking around her feet.
"You brought us into a trap."
"You brought yourself, Eisenhorn," she whispered. "Inchabel sniffed out the traces of our work here on Gershom. It was an ideal opportunity to entice you here and remove your persistent opposition."
"A trap. To silence me."
"And your retinue," she said. "All loose ends."
"You never expected us to get inside this place, though, did you? You meant to kill me, all of us, at Helter."
Jaff's eyes narrowed.
"You got further than expected," she said, "thanks to Drusha. I animated the Revenant at Helter, but it was not sufficient. I was regrouping to make another attempt. You pushed on, despite my efforts to divert you. You opened Kestra's doors, but we have adjusted. We improvise well."
"Is this the truth?" Drusha whispered to Eisenhorn. Eisenhorn was concentrating hard. He looked sick. His cheeks were flushed, and there was sweat on his forehead.
"She can't lie," he grunted. "Not given the psionic coercion I am using."
"Is Max alive?" Drusha asked Jaff. "Have you killed her? Have you killed the others?"
"Don't interrupt,"
snapped Eisenhorn. He was struggling to focus.
"Is this an immaterium loom?"
"Yes,"
Jaff shivered, every word tight and unwilling.
"How long has it been here?"
16 centuries, since it was built. Watched over by a succession of magi."
"Of which Dravensark is the latest?"
"The greatest. He found his grandfather's samples. The torment. The chaos disease. From it, he refined an inoculation. A viral enhancement that would render test subjects immune to etheric corruption. Thus they might withstand the first stages of transformation by the loom."
"Has this worked?"
"There is a high wastage of test subjects," said Jaff.
Drusha could see the horrified look in her eyes. She was fighting not to say these things, and they were coming out anyway.
"A high wastage. But the process has now worked. It worked on Sark. Such devotion. Such self-sacrifice. Such perfection. He has made it work the way Lillian wanted it to."
"To do what?"
"To construct vessels,"
gasped Jaff. Blood was beginning to seep from her left nostril.
"Flesh is weak. What we wish to accomplish surpasses the limits of the human form. We are building better vessels. Vessels that can survive the stresses involved. We call them grails. They are precious, but hard to make."
"I have met a grail before. Grail Ochre."
Jaff shook as if the name hurt her.
"It said it was the Yellow King, or that it served the Yellow King."
"It does,"
whined Jaff.
"And Orpheus. Is that this king's name?"
"Please, stop this," she wailed.
Drusha glanced at Eisenhorn in alarm. Eisenhorn was trembling. His lips had peeled back to reveal his clenched teeth. He looked to be in as much pain as Jaff.
"Tell me."
"Lillian is making the Grail vessels to serve the king in yellow," she moaned.
"And they are vessels for what?"
"To contain the truth of the warp. To be strong enough to speak not one word of Enuncia, but all the words. A fluency in the first language that would shatter human form."
"Like demon hosts, but in reverse. A human soul wrapped in an etheric body, rather than an etheric force bound in human flesh."
"Exactly. They are you, demonic beings."
"Good demons. I would take issue with your terminology."
Jaff snorted, amused. Blood bubbled at her nostrils.
"They are the future. And they are hope," she said. "Through the grails, the truth may be whispered in the ear of the Rot God King and end his domination."
"Well, that makes so much sense now she puts it like that," said Drusha.
"Please be quiet," said Eisenhorn with considerable effort. Jaff was starting to tremble. Blood dripped from her nose, and the drops froze in the ice around her feet.
"How many has he made? How many of these grails has he built?"
"The first eight. They have gone to the Yellow King to be deployed."
"Where?"
Jaff coughed. Blood frothed over her lip. Blood was dribbling from her nose and running from her tear ducts.
"Please stop,"
she spluttered.
"Where?"
"Queen Mab."
"Where is that?"
Sangkor in Angelus.
"Where is Lillian Chase?"
Jaff began to choke.
"Where is she?"
Jaff was quivering wildly. She vomited blood down her front.
"What is the king in yellow?"
"Please,"
Jaff gurgled. Her left eyeball burst.
"Is Max alive?"
Drusha yelled. She shrieked the word, "Yes," as she died. Chapter 17. One Word. Drusha turned away. He leant on the platform's rail and stared at the slowly turning cog systems of the great machine. He didn't want to be sick. He was afraid that if he started, he wouldn't be able to stop.
"That was barbaric," he said quietly.
"It was necessary," replied Eisenhorn, his breathing ragged and rapid.
"And Jaff was a heretic. A murderer. A traitor to me."
Drusha turned around slowly. Eisenhorn was crouching over Jaff's steaming remains.
"No one deserves that," Drusha said.
"You have lived a very sheltered life, Magos," said Eisenhorn. "This galaxy is more cruel and dangerous than you can imagine. When you fight against it, you cannot afford to be sentimental or squeamish."
"I know about you," said Drusha.
"I resent your interruption," said Eisenhorn. "I was interrogating, at great cost to myself. There were a few seconds left. You jumped in with your question."
"I needed to know about Germaine."
"You are fond of the Marshal," said Eisenhorn. "I understand. You must understand she is an insignificant part of this. So are you, and so am I. Your sentiment betrays you. A life or two, 100, 1,000, they are collateral in this war."
"I am quite content to remain a creature of sentiment for the rest of my life," replied Drusha. "I am very glad I'm not like you. I told you. I know about you." "You chose to ignore the remark."
Eisenhorn rose to face him. He looked drawn and deathly pale.
"What is it you think you know, Magos?"
"You are no inquisitor," said Drusha. "Perhaps once, but not now. You are a rogue, disavowed by your own kind. Whatever war you are waging, whatever quest you're on, it's yours alone. You are not sanctioned. There is no official support."
"There is truth in that," said Eisenhorn. "But it only serves to demonstrate that the Holy Orders don't appreciate the extremity or scale of this threat." "I have warned them. They have ignored the warning. Therefore, I must act alone, or no one will stand against it."
"But it bothers you," said Drusha. "You lied. You and Vorier, you maintain the pretense that you are of the Ordos, that you still have that authority. You use that lie to recruit me and to drum up the support of Max and her deputies."
"The rosette of the Inquisition has clout," said Eisenhorn. "It has influence. You would not have assisted me otherwise. Or it would have taken a great deal more persuasion. The guise of Inquisitor is expedient in my work."
"So, it's a useful lie. That's all you have to say on the matter?"
"No," angrily.
Eisenhorn looked at him. There was a fierce gleam in his eyes.
"I am an Inquisitor. It has been my life. I know I am true in the defense of the Golden Throne.
If the echelons of the Inquisition and the other august institutions of the Imperium choose, in their ignorance, to deem me otherwise, then it is they who are wrong, not me.
One might describe that as a terrifying level of self-delusion, sir, said Drusha.
You can describe it however you like, Magos, Eisenhorn replied. He glanced over his shoulder. Someone's coming, he whispered. A psychotic event like this, and Jaff's screams, will not have gone unnoticed.
Drusha followed Eisenhorn across the platform. He didn't really want to, but he wanted to stay put even less. He glanced back at Jaff's remains.
Do we just leave her there?
Hurry,
Eisenhorn replied. They moved down some steps to the next platform stage and hid in the shadows of one of the great cogs. From concealment, they could see the stage they had just left. Eisenhorn reached into his coat and drew a large and ornate auto pistol. It looked the size of a standard carbine to Drusha.
What do we...
Drusha began.
Remain silent.
A man appeared on the platform above. It was the tall man with florid tattoos that Drusha had seen before. He hurried to Jaff's body, recoiled in disgust, then anxiously began to look around, a las pistol raised.
Blig,
he called. The heavy man appeared a moment later, out of breath.
What did you find? What was that cry?
He asked. Jeff's done for.
Damn,
the fat man gasped, seeing the corpse.
Eisenhorn's handiwork, replied the tattooed man. He's here, and he's loose.
What did he do to her?
The fat man asked, tilting his head in ghastly fascination as he stared at Jaff's body.
Who cares, Blague? We have to find him before he does worse.
Streakel's already hunting,
said Blague, running a pudgy hand through his thin grey hair. He hefted up the heavy combat las he was carrying.
Streakel's efficient, but she'll need help, replied the tattooed man. This bastard is as dangerous as his reputation suggests. Go up to the cage. Tell Goblika what's happened.
He'll be furious, Da Vinci.
Of course he will. So tell him gently.
Da Vinci, the tattooed man, glanced at his portly colleague.
Go on.
Where are you going?
Blague asked.
I'll check down from here, said Da Vinci. Right down to the cellar. I want to see if Jeff put that Magos fool in a cage before this happened to her. Otherwise, we've got two interlopers loose. And tell Goblika someone needs to get outside. There's the other loose end, the Betancourt woman. She needs to be tidied up too.
Blague nodded. He walked away and began to climb the steps.
Hurry!
Da Vinci shouted after him.
Goblika may even want to request an outside assist to get this squared away.
Blague disappeared out of sight. Da Vinci had drawn both pistols. He circled the platform and began to move towards the steps close to Eisenhorn and Drusha. Eisenhorn placed a hand on Drusha's arm. Drusha felt an uncomfortable, psychanic tap. The tattooed man suddenly looked around, as if he'd heard someone call his name. He made off in the opposite direction and quickly vanished behind the gears of the great machine.
You could have shot him, said Drusha quietly.
I could, said Eisenhorn, but I don't want to bring the whole place down on us. We are the last two, Drusha. Silence and shadows are our friends.
Our friends? While we do what, exactly?
He mentioned Sark and Goblika.
I've seen them both, said Drusha. A long way above us, there's a cage on a gantry. A psychometric monitor. Is that the right term? Magos Sark is in it. Caged like an animal. He's become the, I don't know, focus of this machine. He's part of it. It's working because of him.
So Jaff said.
But his mind is gone, said Drusha. He's very damaged. This Goblika fellow, he seems to be the one running the operation now.
Goran Goblika is an expert fixer. The Cognite value his skills. But Sark is the primary target. We have to stop him. Stop this loom manufacturing any more grails for the King in Yellow.
I didn't understand any of what Jaff told you, said Drusha. What are they trying to achieve?
I don't expect you to understand, Magos,
Eisenhorn replied.
Frankly, I don't want you to understand. But so you grasp the vital nature of this, the Cognite, through the King in Yellow, are working to bring down the Imperium. I believe their goal is no less than the assassination of the Emperor. So, when we are done here,
I will go to the Angelus subsector, to Sancor, and I will find this place called Queen Mab, and there I will hunt down and destroy the King in Yellow. But first, this place must be ended, so it can construct no more monsters to serve his scheme.
Drusha nodded. Then let's get Max and—
She's not a priority, said Eisenhorn.
She's alive, Eisenhorn.
And I'm sorry for that. But she is not the priority here, Magos.
We can't just leave her—
We can.
No, said Drusha. I can't.
Magos, do you still not understand the importance of—
I do, interrupted Drusha firmly. But as you took pains to point out, I am a creature of sentiment. I won't leave my friend to die. You can help me, or you can get on with waging your private war. I'm going to the cellars. I think that's where she may be. If you come, we can get it done quickly. Then we can both help you deal with Sark.
There isn't time, said Eisenhorn.
Then off you go, and good luck to you, said Drusha.
Eisenhorn glared at him.
Don't try and pull rank, said Drusha. You're not an inquisitor, and I'm not one of your lackeys.
You are a very aggravating man, Magos, said Eisenhorn.
One of my few real skills. Tell me, did you suspect Jaff?
I suspect everyone,
said Eisenhorn. Hence the levels of secrecy and confidence you exhibited at Helter, telling no one anything, sharing nothing. You don't trust anyone, do you?
I can't afford to, Magos.
I pity you, said Drusha.
I trust those I've known a long time, said Eisenhorn quietly. Medea. Nail.
He fell silent as he spoke the name. Then he glanced back at Drusha.
I was sure there was a spy in my company, he said, even before I arrived on Gershom. That is why I kept things classified. I thought it was Vorier.
Vorier? Really?
He was interrogator to Inquisitor Syriac. He is genuinely an officer of the Ordos. He came to me 2 years ago, saying that he wished to join me, that he believed in my cause, and felt that the Ordos were blind to the real threat. In effect, he went rogue and joined me.
But you didn't trust him?
Vorier is very able, and was a decent addition to my party. But no, I never trusted him. I believed him to be a double agent, claiming to be a renegade, but sent by the Ordos to infiltrate my operation.
Yet you kept him close, asked Drusha. You didn't kill him just in case?
Vorier was useful, and he's a good man, replied Eisenhorn. I was aware of his true loyalties, so I treated him warily. But I hoped. I hoped that if I let him work with me, he might see the truth. He might become convinced of the danger, that the threat was genuine.
And side with you for real?
Drusha paused.
No, you wanted more than that, didn't you? You hoped that he would report to his masters in the Ordos and convince them your cause was true. Convince them that you were no rogue. He was your way back in, your chance to be accepted back into the folds of the Inquisition.
You are astute.
It's so ironic, sir, said Drusha. Ironic to the point of comedy. You suspect everyone. You believe there's a spy in your midst. You think it's Vorier, perhaps correctly, but you use him for your own ends, to rebuild the bridges you burned with the Inquisition. And then the real spy turns out to be Jaff. Not just an agent of your ex-masters, but worse, an agent of your true enemy.
She hid it well. That's what the Cognite do.
You hate that the Ordos cast you out, don't you? Asked Drusha. You hate the fact they declared you a heretic.
I hate the fact that the Ordos are blind and stubborn, replied Eisenhorn. I could achieve a great deal more, a great deal faster, if I had their blessing, their cooperation, and their not inconsiderable support.
Or you have no friends and you don't like it, said Drusha.
Pure sentiment, Eisenhorn responded.
Well, I have a friend, and I'm going to help her.
This is a dangerous location, Magos, and you are no combatant. You don't have the skill set to do her any good.
So? Help me, said Drusha.
No, said Eisenhorn. Max is not a priority.
That there, sir, is why you don't have any friends, said Drusha. He turned away. I'll go do whatever I can. You go do what you need to do. I hope this isn't goodbye, but I think it probably is. And so I wish you well in your efforts.
He walked down the platform and began to descend the stairs. Eisenhorn stood and watched him for a while, then turned, limping painfully, and disappeared in the opposite direction. Drusha stopped and looked back. Eisenhorn was gone.
Throne,
he muttered to himself. He had been quite sure Eisenhorn was going to change his mind and come after him. The old bastard really was as cold as stone. And now Drusha was alone. He had no clue what he was going to do or how he could achieve it. Eisenhorn had been right. Valentin Drusha was no fighter. He wasn't going to last a second against any of Goblika's ruthless minions. He was way out of his depth. He had been since the moment Harlan Nail had hammered on his front door. He continued down the steps. For what little good it might do, he took the gun out of his coat pocket and clutched it tightly. It took a while to reach the base levels of the tower. Longer, in fact, than Drusha fancied it should have taken, as if the tower were much taller than any real tower could be, as if its dimensions stretched down into impossible depths. He moved slowly, hugging the shadows, flinching every time a metal step or platform panel creaked under him. The constant movement and whirring of the huge loom's gears around him kept making him start. He jumped at every shifting machine part, imagining each motion to be the movement of some cognate henchman stalking him. Finally, he climbed down through the huge wrought-iron girder frame that supported the weight of the loom. The frame was as substantial as a major road bridge, and its fabric was built into the walls of the tower. Further high-tension steel cables were cross-anchored around the frame to support the immense weight. Looking down from a catwalk that ran under the heavy frame, Drusha saw a platform built out from the tower wall in the void beneath. It was large, ragged and uneven, a patchwork of steel plates and flakboarding. It looked like a part of the hull skin of an old ship that had been peeled away and repurposed as flooring. Where it extended out over the void, it sagged and became more frayed, its feathered edge dangling above the darkness below. Below it, the tower walls continued down into the dark still further, but Drusha could see a glint in the blackness that suggested the very base of the tower was filled with promethium or some other dark, viscous fluid. Beneath the level of the great iron frame, everything was slightly sheened with oil, every surface tacky with a fine brown stain. The loom had run, so Jaff had said, for centuries. Precision engineering required lubricant to keep it moving smoothly. Drusha imagined the constant tending and attention the loom above him had received over the years, the regular application of lubricant and grease to the gears and cogs. Movement and gravity combined to gently remove the lubricant from the great machine, and this is where the residue ended up, draining into a sump in the tower's base, a deep well of pooling waste oil. There was a row of cages on the ragged platform. They looked like the metal box cage that had contained Sark. Six cages placed against the tower wall. Nearby was a small laboratory station, an old auto-medicare unit, and some metal storage bins. The whole area was gloomy, lit only by dozens of fat candles ranged around the platform and the work area. It looked uncomfortably like a shrine, like a place of unwholesome ritual. By the flickering yellow light of the candles, Drusha could see that two of the cages were occupied. He moved around for a better look. A rough metal staircase ran down from the catwalk to the edge of the platform. The hunched figure in one of the cages was Jermaine Max. A crumpled body lay in the cage beside her. The floors of the other cages were littered with blackened human bones. Drusha crept to the head of the stairs. There appeared to be no one else around. His heart racing, he climbed down the stairs. Max looked up and saw him as he stepped onto the platform. She lurched to the front bars of the cage and peered out at him.
"Valentin? Oh, holy throne, Valentin!"
He smiled at her and put his finger to his lips. The pistol was still in his hand. He put it in his pocket and shushed her properly.
"Keep your voice down, Jermaine," he hissed.
He hurried over to her cage. She looked up at him with wild eyes. She was filthy, and the side of her face was swollen and badly bruised. He knelt down and looked in at her. She grabbed his hand through the bars.
"What did they do to you?" he asked. "Hit me," she said. "Club me with a rifle stock. I'm all right. Don't look so worried, Valentin. Just get me out of here."
He let go of her hand and started to examine the cage. There was plainly a door, but there was no lock, no keyhole,
He tried to pull the door open. "I've tried that," she said sarcastically. "I'm sure you have." "He closed it with a word," she said.
"Who did?"
"The one who clubbed me. Big bastard. Black hair, freaky violet eyes."
"Goblika," said Drusha.
"Well, when I get out of here, he's a dead man," she said. "He killed Garifa and Edda."
"Both of them?" asked Drusha.
"Cold blood. I had surrendered, and he just..."
Her voice trailed off.
"Hadid deserved a better end than that," she said miserably. "They both did."
"What do you mean he closed it with a word?" asked Drusha, trying the cage door again.
"I came to as he was putting me in here," she said. "He swung the door shut, then said a word, and it was locked fast."
"Enantia,"
said a hoarse voice from the next cage. Drusha looked up. The other prisoner was Vorier. He was a mess. His throat and forehead were black with bruises, and his eyes were halfway swollen shut. The interrogator tried to struggle into a sitting position, but he was clearly in agony.
"They used Enantia,"
Vorier said. It sounded like his throat was full of blood.
"Do you remember the word he used?" Drusha asked Max. She shook her head.
"It wasn't really a word," she said. "I didn't understand it."
"Do you know anything of Enantia that might help us, Vorier?" Drusha asked.
"I would have used it already if I did,"
Vorier replied.
"Eisenhorn keeps that knowledge to himself."
"How are you hurt?"
"Broken arm, smashed hand,"
replied Vorier. He gestured to his face and throat with his left hand.
"And this?"
"Where is everyone else?"
Max asked Drusha urgently.
"Nail's dead," said Drusha. "Jaff, too. She was the one who betrayed us."
"Jaff?"
Vorier said.
Drusha looked over at Vorier.
"She was one of them, sir," Drusha said. "A cognite spy in your midst. She was the one who sicked that thing on us in Helter Fortress."
"I can't believe it,"
Max whispered, rocking back in amazement. Vorier was clearly shaken by the idea.
"Audler,"
he whispered, uncomprehending.
"She was cognite," said Drusha.
"But she... we trusted her,"
said Vorier.
"Trust seems to be a real issue with you people," said Drusha.
"Anyway, she's gone now. Eisenhorn, he dealt with her."
"Eisenhorn's alive?"
asked Vorier.
"Yes. Why isn't he with you?" asked Max.
"He had better things to do," said Drusha. He ran his fingers along the door edge again.
"What do you mean?" she asked.
Drusha glanced at Vorier.
"Priorities. Isn't that right, interrogator?"
Drusha asked.
"Stopping Sark, stopping all of this. It's what matters to him. We're all expendable."
"Screw him," snapped Max.
"It's unfortunate," said Vorier, "but I understand. This heresy must be brought to an end. We are of less consequence."
"Ah, yes," said Drusha sarcastically. "Duty."
"We are sworn to our duty, sir,"
said Vorier.
"Even renegades and rogues?" asked Drusha. "I know all about him, Vorier."
"And he knows all about you."
"What do you mean, Magos?"
asked Vorier.
"That you joined his rogue band to watch him. That you affect sympathy to his cause, yet all the while you operate at the bidding of your Ordo masters.
He suspected you from the start."
"That's not true,"
said Vorier.
"By all means deny it, Vorier. It's probably safer. But he knows what you are. And he keeps you close because he hopes you will learn and see for yourself the legitimacy of his work, and vouch for him to your masters."
"You're talking rubbish," growled Vorier.
"Look where you are, Vorier," said Drusha. "In a cage, in a cognite stronghold, in, what's the word, extimate space? The immaterium loom hums, sir, making weapons called grails to form an army that the cognite's king in yellow will unleash against Terra. Look at the evidence and tell me this is not a battle that the Holy Order should be fighting. They should listen to Eisenhorn. They should help him, support him, not declare him a heretic."
Vorier didn't reply.
"Where are you getting this from, Valentin?" Max asked, wide-eyed.
Drusha shrugged.
"From the lips of Eisenhorn himself," he replied.
"And from the mouth of that traitor Jaff. But it doesn't matter, Germaine. It's not business for ordinary people like you and me. It is way above us. It's part of a greater, darker cosmos that we are barely aware of in our day-to-day lives.
So I'm just going to get you out of here, and then we can go somewhere far away and forget all about it.
How?
She asked. How what? How are you going to get me out of here? She asked. That, he conceded, is a problem. This damn door won't budge, and I don't know any magic word to open it.
Drusha sat back and thought. He got up and wandered across to the workstation. It was cluttered with dirty surgical equipment and glass sample tubes he was quite certain he didn't want to touch. He looked around for a tool or instrument he could use to lever the door open. As he searched, his movement wafted the flames of the fat candles dotted around the workspace. There was nothing usable in any of the drawers. He checked the storage bins. Surely some tools. A crowbar. Nothing. Just junk and more old Medicaid supplies.
Wait, he said suddenly. Wait, wait, wait. What? Asked Max.
She and Vorier stared at Drusha as he hurried back to them. Drusha pulled the gun out of his pocket and looked at it.
Custom bullets, he said. That's what poor Nail said. Custom bullets, like the one he used to finish that undead thing. Etched by Eisenhorn himself, like amulets, to break this magic.
He aimed the weapon at the doorframe.
Whoa, whoa!
Max cried in alarm.
What? Asked Drusha. I know I'm not very good with guns, but... I don't care what that thing's loaded with, said Max. You're aiming point-blank at cast iron, Valentin. It'll ricochet, or you'll miss the bars and hit me.
The Marsh is right, said Vorier. That's not going to work.
I suppose not, said Drusha. He laughed sadly. I was almost feeling heroic for a second there.
He paused, then turned the gun around in his hand and fumbled with it until he managed to eject the clip.
What are you doing? Asked Max.
Drusha slid the top bullet out into his palm. He tucked the gun and the clip away in his coat pocket and held the bullet up to the light.
There's a word etched on it, all right,
he said, squinting at it.
Throne knows what it is. I've never seen anything like it.
So? Asked Max.
I need to...
Drusha said, thinking.
I need to make a... cast, or...
Clutching the bullet, he went back to the workstation and carefully picked up one of the candles. Its flame guttered and twitched. Wax dripped off its base and dribbled down his fingers. He used an old glass specimen slide to scrape up hot, soft wax from the desktop. He went back to the cages quickly and began to shape a lump of soft wax on the doorframe, roughly where a lock would have been.
What are you doing?
Asked Max.
Concentrating, said Drusha as he worked. Damn, this stuff is surprisingly hard to work with. There. Now what?
Asked Max.
Just let it cool for a second, he said. Talk to me.
What?
While we wait, he said, smiling. I'm scared out of my wits here, Germaine. Talk to me. Tell me something.
Like what?
I don't know. Something. Something from the old days that was good. I still think about the old days, you know. I think about you. I was a useless husband.
I know exactly what you were when I married you, she said.
So you should have known better,
he laughed. She managed a smile.
We both should, Valentin, she said. You are an extraordinary man, Valentin.
A magus biologus. Your life is driven by your work,
as is mine.
We both should have known better. We shouldn't have been such damn optimists.
Optimists or romantics?
He asked.
Both, she admitted. When did we stop being optimists, Germaine?
He asked.
About 15 years ago, in Tycho City, she said, smiling.
It's a shame, he said.
I think I should have made more of a life. Made time for things. Been more than a magos. I think we should be optimists again.
Do you? She asked.
Yes,
he nodded.
Because then there's a better chance of this working.
He bent down and tested the wax blob.
Let's see now, he said.
He took out the bullet, lined up the word etched on its case, and gently pressed it into the wax. When he took the bullet away, a mirror print of the inhuman word was impressed in the blob.
Now what?
Max asked. Drusha tried the cage door. It was still locked fast.
We wait, he said. It may take a moment for the charm to take effect.
You're just making this up as you go along, aren't you? Said Max.
Story of my life, he replied. All made up as it goes along.
Preposterous and unlikely.
Like one of poor Hadid Garafar's fairy tales. Everything's felt like that, especially since you came to the Bone Coast to find me. Fantastical and unnatural, and following a set of rules no one has bothered to explain to me.
It could work, said Vorier.
He had pulled himself up close to the bars of his cage to watch.
The charm marking, it could break the word lock, Enantia conflicting with Enantia.
Let's hope so, said Drusha. Max rattled the cage door. It doesn't seem to be, she said.
He could hear her rising tension.
Just be patient, Germaine. Give it a moment.
Easy for you to say, she snapped. You're not in here.
Tell me about Trueheart, he said, trying to distract her.
What?
Did you wear it specially, or do you always wear it? Drusha asked.
I bought you that bottle years ago. If you used it regularly, it wouldn't have lasted.
Do you keep buying it?
To remind myself of you.
You wish.
So you wore it specially?
She shrugged. It was in a drawer. I just thought
it would help you convince me, said Drusha quietly, if you smelled the way I remembered you.
It would make me feel like you still cared.
Make me believe it was more than an official visit.
Max sighed.
I'm sorry, she said.
Don't be. It was clever.
You were just doing your job.
Subliminal persuasion.
No, she said. I'm sorry I put it on. I mean, that's why I put it on, to put you at ease, to remind you of a time when we were close, but I'm sorry I did it.
Why?
He asked. She looked at him through the bars.
Because it reminded me of a time when we were close, too, she said.
Drusha reached his hand in through the bars, and she took it.
It's going to be all right, Germaine, he said. You and me, side by side. Insane adventures.
Which you always hated.
I just think of them fondly in hindsight, he said. They were high jinks compared to this.
It isn't working, she said.
The reassurance?
The wax charm, she replied. She let go of his hand and shook at the cage door again.
Just be patient, he said.
There's no time for patience, Magus, said Vorier sharply.
Drusha looked around. The woman with the cropped red hair was coming down the steps onto the platform. She stared at him, smiled, and drew her sidearm.
Chapter 18. Dead or Alive.
Drusha ripped the pistol from his pocket and aimed it at her.
Don't, he said. Not another step.
The woman's smile broadened.
That's the bitch who hurt me, said Vorier.
Her name is Strykow, said Drusha. Strykow, right?
Yes, the woman said.
Here's what's going to happen, Mademoiselle Strykow, said Drusha.
He kept the gun aimed and tried not to let on how badly he was shaking.
Stop where you are and toss your weapon now.
Or what? She asked.
Or I shoot you between the eyes, he said. I am a very good shot. Marshal Max gave me this gun many years ago. She showed me how to use it. I have practiced with it every day. I can knock a moving Gortus-Gortuska show me out of the sky at 100 meters.
What? Asked Streakle sarcastically.
A sea raptor.
A sea raptor, growled Vorier from his cage.
See? You do learn,
Drusha said sidelong. He glared at Strykow.
Toss the weapon now, he said.
Be careful, warned Vorier. She is very, very fast. Don't let her get close.
Drusha thumbed back the hammer.
Lose the gun now, mamselle, he said.
Strykow stopped in her tracks. Her eyes narrowed, and her smile dissolved. She raised her sidearm, a compact las pistol, keeping her fingers open to show she had no real grip on it, then threw it aside. It hit the workstation and bounced onto the floor.
You won't get out of here alive, she said. Don't think about shouting for help, said Drusha.
I won't.
You won't get out of here alive, because I'm going to kill you. Let's see how you do when you're bound and gagged, said Drusha.
Strykow raised her hands.
Go on then, she said.
Don't get close to her, Vorier hissed.
Valentin, what are you even going to tie her up with?
Demanded Max, shaking the cage door again.
Valentin, just shoot her! I'd prefer not to kill people unless I absolutely have to, said Drusha.
Then give me the gun and I'll do it, snapped Max. Her hands still raised, Strykow took a step closer. She moved with slow poise, like a ballet dancer.
Come on then, Magus, she said. Tie me up. Make it tight.
Stay where you are, Drusha warned. She took another step.
For throne's sake, growled Vorier. Kill her, Magus. She is lethal.
He's right, said Strykow, taking another step. Please stop coming closer, said Drusha.
His hand was really trembling.
I'd really be very upset if I had to kill you.
Streakerl took another pace forward.
Throne, forgive me, said Drusha. I'm sorry.
He pulled the trigger. The gun clicked. Drusha stared at it in disbelief. He remembered taking the clip out to remove the bullet. The clip was still in his pocket.
Valentin!
Max screamed. Streakerl leapt forwards, grinning. She was faster than any human being he'd ever seen. She slammed into him and kicked him in the chest. Drusha flew back against the bars of Max's cage. He could hear Max shrieking his name. He was winded. His chest burned. The world was spinning. Streakerl grabbed him by the front of his coat and hauled him to his feet. He tried to hit her with the useless gun. She blocked and sent it spinning out of his grasp. You're so dead, she said. She shoved him backwards. He staggered and grabbed the bars of Vorier's cage to steady himself. The platform surface was uneven and sticky with oil residue. Vorier and Max were yelling at him. Max had started to kick furiously at the door of her cage. It reminded Drusha of the way they had kicked the firebox out of the parlor grate, desperate and frantic. Max was putting every ounce of her strength into kicking the iron door, a door that would not open. Drusha had no idea what he was going to do. He didn't know how to fight. He hadn't the first clue how to throw a punch. Streakerl was on him. She was smiling broadly. She had drawn a wicked-looking punch dagger. The blade glinted in the candlelight. Drusha scrambled. He had to dodge somehow. Streakerl lunged. Drusha tried to evade. He felt so clumsy, so slow. He lost his footing. His boots slid on the oil-slicked decking, and he went down hard on his backside. Streakle's dagger punch missed him by a hair's breadth and struck the bars of Vorier's cage instead. She barked in pain at the abrupt impact and started to turn. A hand grabbed her wrist through the bars of the cage. Wincing in agony, Vorier had seized her with his good hand. He wrenched her back with his full body weight and slammed her into the bars of the cage, pulling her arm and the punch dagger into the cage with him. She fought back. She reached into the cage with her left hand and struck at Vorier as he clung on. Max was still kicking at her cage door and shouting Drusha's name. Drusha hauled himself upright. He knew he needed a weapon. There was nothing to hand. He launched himself at Streakerl and pummeled his fist at her. With her arm pinned between the bars by Vorier, she couldn't turn properly. One of Drusha's blows connected. He caught the back of her head so hard it felt like he had broken his fingers. The impact bounced Streakle's face off the bars. She snarled in pain. Drusha staggered back, clutching his hand. He was still dizzy, and his feet were slipping. His chest burned so badly he couldn't catch his breath. He could hear the constant crash of Max's boot against the unyielding cage door, her voice screaming his name. Streakerl plunged her left arm through the bars again. She got hold of Vorier's useless right arm and twisted. Broken bone ends ground against each other. Vorier shrieked in abject pain and fell backwards, his grip on her right wrist lost. Streakerl pulled her arms out of the cage. She turned to Drusha and raised the punch dagger. The collision with the cage bars had broken her nose and split her lip. Blood was running down her chin. She wiped it away with her left wrist. "You are going to know such pain," she hissed as she came for him. Drusha leapt backwards. He slipped again and fell on his back. She landed on him, flattened her left forearm across his neck to keep him pinned, and raised the blade of the punch dagger to his cheek. "Such pain," she promised, and started to cut. The door of Max's cage crashed wide so hard it opened 180 degrees on its hinges and slammed against the metal bars. Max flew out, bellowing. She landed on them both and wrenched Streakerl backwards, clawing at her. The pair of them rolled off Drusha, locked together. Streakerl tried to push the punch dagger low to stab Max in the ribs. Max grabbed her wrist and pinned it high. She rolled again, getting Streakerl on her back, and tried to slam her hand against the deck to make her drop the blade. Streakerl growled like an animal and went for Max's throat with her teeth. Max called her the filthiest word Drusha had ever heard her call anybody and headbutted Streakerl in the face. Streakle's skull slammed back into the deck. She groaned, dazed. Max slammed her head against the deck again, and the dagger spun away. Streakerl tried to squirm. Max punched her in the jaw. "Stay down!" Max shouted. Streakerl did not obey. Max knew how to fight. She was a trained marshal, but Streakle's combat training was far superior to the magistratum's. She lifted her shoulders, arched her back, and hoisted Max off the ground. Max lost her balance and started to slide and roll. Streakerl bent her legs, got both feet under Max's belly, and kicked hard. Max went flying backwards. Streakerl leapt up and landed on her. Now she was on top. Her hands closed around Max's throat and began to squeeze.
Max fought back, but she couldn't shift the woman's weight off her. She began to choke. Drusha grabbed Streakle and tried to drag her off Max. Streakle jerked backwards with an elbow that left Drusha bent over on his knees, all the air knocked out of him. He wheezed helplessly, trying to refill his lungs, tears running down his face. Streakle got off Max and straightened up. Max lay on her back, gasping, unable to breathe or move. Calmly, Streakle walked over to the workstation and retrieved her las pistol. She came back and stood over Drusha and Max. She aimed the weapon at Max's face.
"Heretic bitch!" Warrior yelled from his cage in hopeless pain. "You'll burn in eternity for this!"
"I do hope so," said Streakle. A shot cracked out. Streakle took a step backwards. She looked puzzled. She swayed. Another shot hit her, and a ribbon of blood and tissue spurted from her back. She staggered. She looked down at the two bloody holes in her torso, trying to make sense of them. Then she looked up. Harlan Nail limped across the platform towards her. He was battered, dried blood caking the side of his face. He was aiming his large automatic pistol at her.
"That's two," he said. "Do you know how to die, or do you need another lesson?"
Swaying drunkenly, Streakle raised her pistol to aim at him. Nail fired again. Streakle dropped her gun. Her arm flopped back against her side. She took a couple of awkward wobbling steps, then fell down. The slope of the sagging platform rolled her body over a couple of times. Then she simply began to slide on the tarry surface. Her corpse dropped off the platform lip. They heard it hit the deep, ancient pool of Prometheum far below. Chapter 19. The engine wakes.
"Where's Streakle?"
asked Koblika, his intimidating violet stare fixed on Davinch and Blake.
"She's hunting for him," said Blake.
"And Jaff's prisoner might be loose too?"
asked Koblika.
"That's possible," said Davinch.
"Didn't you check the cellar?"
Davinch hesitated.
"I was going to," he replied. "I was on my way down. Then I heard you call my name, so—"
"I didn't call your name, you idiot," snapped Koblika. "I've been up here all the time. You wouldn't have heard me."
"But—" Davinch began.
"He was playing with you," sneered Koblika. "Psychana tricks, you idiot. He's trying to game us."
He turned slowly, surveying the expanse of the loom visible from the main gantry. In the cage behind him, Sark shivered and whimpered.
"He's a monster,"
mumbled Blake.
"You should have seen it, Koblika, what he did to Jaff."
"She deserved anything she got," replied Koblika. "She let them get in here. She let them walk right in."
"Wasn't that the point?" asked Davinch. "To bring them here? To silence them?"
"Not inside the hall, you idiot," said Koblika.
"Well, maybe not that," replied Davinch.
"But it makes it easier. They're trapped. They're confused. This place messes with your head, especially when you're not used to it." "Da Vinci, if I'd wanted to bring them inside to kill them," said Koblika, "I'd have called in reinforcements, proactive specialists, a kill team from the Skolem on Gudrun, maybe negotiate some cooperation from the traitor hosts, or even petition the king to lend us a grail. This is a mess. There's no time for any of that now. An outside assist would take days or weeks to arrive."
"Yeah, but—"
Da Vinci began.
"Weeks, Da Vinci," said Koblika firmly. "We don't have weeks."
"But we've killed four of them," said Blake, "and two more caged up. Maybe three, if Jaff got that Magos shut away before she died. That just leaves the old bastard himself."
"The others don't matter, you asshole," said Koblika. "They're just foot soldiers, 10 a penny. The old bastard is the old bastard for a reason. We've got an alpha-class psyker with a grudge loose in here. Either of you combat psykers? Didn't frigging think so. I've got to blank him. I've got to use Sark."
He turned and looked at the cage.
"I've got to use you now, haven't I, Magos?" he called.
"Magos! Magos!"
the naked wretch in the cage gurgled back.
"Blake, get the kit," said Koblika.
"Wait, Koran," said Davinch, stepping forwards. "That's not a good idea. Chase will have your guts. The instructions were clear. Sark is a creative asset. We use what strength he has to manufacture. He's not a proactive weapon, and we don't waste his power using him that way.
The friggin' rules were changed when Jaff ballsed it up, Da Vinci, said Kablika. Chase might not like it. The king might not like it. But they'll see it was necessary.
But if you damage him...
We'll keep him sound, said Kablika.
Kablika, Sark's burning out, said Da Vinci. He's still exhausted from the last weaving. He needs time to recover. And if you start him up and use his power, we don't know how many more constructs we'll get out of him. We may not meet our quota. Or at the very least, we could fall months behind.
Kablika walked across the platform until he was nose to nose with the tall, tattooed man. Da Vinci pulled back a little.
Yes, said Kablika. Chase will be furious. Imagine how much more furious she'll be if we allow Eisenhorn to shut this place down. She'd bring us back from the dead just to kill us all over again. Protecting this place is our first responsibility. The Cognite cannot lose the loom. It's not an option. He must be found and finished before he can do any damage to it. So, we've got to use Sark.
Da Vinci nodded reluctantly.
Besides, Kablika added, the other one's out there. What's her name?
Betancourt,
said Plague. Right. She needs to be wiped too. We can't risk any word of this getting off-world. So, Sark can handle that as well. Plague, get the kit.
The portly man nodded and hurried off the gantry to a lower platform. Kablika put his assault weapon down on the deck and went over to the cage. He crouched down.
Migos,
he called softly.
Draven, you stay calm now. You hear me?
The man in the cage moaned and curled up in a tight ball. Kablika put his hand on the frame of the cage door and said a single word that made Da Vinci cringe. The cage door swung open. Sark whined and curled up even tighter. Blake returned, carrying a Medicaid pack. He opened the case, prepped an injector, and handed it to Kablika.
Full dose? Asked Kablika.
Blague nodded. Kablika crawled into the cage. Sark shrank back from him, becoming agitated. Kablika grabbed him, pinned him with one arm, and jabbed the injector into the meat of his left buttock. Sark squealed. Kablika let him go, slid out of the cage, and sealed it again with an unword. Sark began to twitch, and then the twitching grew to a violent thrashing. He contorted and twisted, veins bulging, his limbs spasming.
Hell's teeth, murmured Da Vinci as he watched. It takes him longer to come back every time.
There will come a time when he won't come back at all, said Blake.
Then we'll find a replacement, said Kablika. We always knew that day would come.
His voice trailed off.
What?
Asked Blake.
The old bastard, said Kablika.
Da Vinci and Blake turned in terror, expecting to see Eisenhorn behind them.
Idiots!
Kablika laughed.
Think about it. Think about it. We could turn this mess into a huge victory. Turn it right around. End the threat of Eisenhorn and replace the one failing component of this system.
Eisenhorn?
Asked Plague.
He's perfect. He's strong. Mentally. Physically. The Psychana aspect is a huge advantage. He's already attuned.
Yeah, but his mindset, said Da Vinci. He wouldn't cooperate. He wouldn't be willing.
You think that animal is willing?
Asked Kablika, pointing at the man writhing and gasping in the cage.
He was to begin with,
said Blake.
The viral shots will destroy the old bastard's resistance, said Kablika. They'll negate his will, his self, and rewire his brain and his soul. We'll break him and reshape him. I don't think it'll be hard, either. Eisenhorn's been on the edge for too long. Decades. He's been declared a damn heretic for terror's sake. It won't be a stretch for him. He's seen the warp. He knows it's a lure. We'll just tip him over the threshold so he sees the real truth. He'll realize where he should have been from the very start. He'll embrace it like a long-lost love.
Kablika grinned broadly at the two men beside him.
Anchis and the king, he said, they will relish the sheer poetry of their greatest adversary becoming their most valuable asset.
Gorin?
A weak voice called from inside the cage.
Gorin, are you there?
Goblika took a look at his colleagues.
Get moving, both of you, he said. Find Strykal. Kill anyone else you find. Anyone, caged or not. If you encounter Eisenhorn, try and drive him this way.
If he fights? Asked Da Vinci.
Then kill him if you have to. But only if you have to. Intact or alive enough to work with. That's preferable. Get on with it.
Da Vinci and Blake looked at each other, then turned and left the gantry. Goblika